I'm very happy to be here at the University of Virginia, where I did my graduate education what seems now like many years ago. So it's good to be home. I'm a Virginia native. Good to be back on UVA's campus, and I'm very appreciative to distinguished Professor McDowell for having extended to me the invitation to come and be a part of this great event. When talking about the NAACP, an organization for about 100 years, obviously many stories that can be told nationally, state level, local, regional. For the purpose of this symposium, I have decided to focus my attention specifically on the NAACP in Virginia. So grateful that Larry and Steven and sit back down in the meeting. But anyway, our papers will complement each other very well. The NAACP, as you all know, had a very strong record in Virginia long before Farmville, Virginia, in Prince Edward County, being part of Brown Board of Education Litigation. The NAACP's primary proof in the school desegregation fight that had hit in Virginia was the state's political organization that you all know as the Powerful Bird Machine. As governor of Virginia in the 1920s, Harry Bloomberg Sr. had consolidated government positions and used patronage to create a political oligarchy that ruled Virginia during the early 20th century. For much of that time, his base of operations lay in D.C., as he represented Virginia in the United States Senate from 1933 to 1965. He saw the Democrat known for his fiscal and social conservatism, Byrd regularly clashed with the National Democratic Party over the latter's growing support of civil rights. Virginia schools have been racially segregated since their founding, just after the Civil War. When the state revised its constitution in 1902, segregated education was required by law. During the debate over the state's 1902 constitution, Paul Barrington, who's chairman of the faculty at the University of Virginia, argued that educational opportunities for blacks be limited to, and this is a quote, a Sunday school training, because the main function of the state's black population was, another quote, to provide a source of cheap labor for a warm climate. By the 1920s, Virginia's state law had expanded segregation to include virtually every aspect of life, and the results for black children were devastating. In 1925, Virginia spent an average of $40.27 to educate each white student, and only $10.47 on each black student. In the 1930s, the Virginia NAACP brought legal attacks against these inequities, and attorneys Howard Hill and Spotswood Robinson played major roles in those cases. But what I want to talk about this morning is the other people that sometimes we don't hear much about and work behind the scenes, who were equally important. A lot of the people played major roles in the NAACP in Virginia, those folk who sometimes worked behind the scenes assisting the lawyers. And they were not waging the legal battles in the courtroom. The people like, for instance, say Lester Banks, who was hired in 1947. As the first full-time executive director of the Virginia State Conference on Branches. William Lester Banks was born in Lunenburg County, Virginia in 1911. He taught school in Halifax County, later he became principal at an all-black school in Charles City County. In 1943, he approached Oliver Hill about filing a lawsuit to equalize black and white facilities in his school. But they were unable to pursue their course of action at that time because both of them would soon be drafted into the U.S. Armed Forces. Banks would later serve in the Army as a sergeant during World War II. When the war was over, he picked up where he left off. Sometimes Lester Banks acted with others in protesting segregation and discrimination, but he soon developed a reputation for bravery because he was not afraid to act alone. Indeed, if you go back and study the life of Lester Banks and look at some of his encounters, you will see that many of his encounters with the local segregationist establishment in Virginia were very similar to those of the Reverend Graham Jones in Montgomery, Alabama. In October 1961, Banks was arrested for trespassing after he sought and was refused service twice in the section of a restaurant in Lynchburg. 2 years later, a white sawmill worker assaulted him when he staged a sit-in at the section reserved for white patrons in Charlotte County. By persistently refusing to sit apart from white attorneys in Virginia courtrooms, an act of which local officials were reluctant to arrest him, Banks helped bring about the desegregation of Virginia's courthouses. Among the things Banks is best remembered for is that he often ventured courageously, indeed some would say foolishly, into hostile territory, with the letters NAACP emblazoned in bold print on the rear window of his car. Banks devoted most of his efforts to desegregating the public schools in Virginia. Now, his work, along with the attorneys already mentioned, brought the legal resources of the NAACP to bear on the every 13-year struggle to desegregate the public schools in Prince Edward County. And as you all know, that would become part of Brown v. Board of Education. As much as any other Virginian of his generation, he stood up for civil rights and fought for justice. He would remain executive secretary of the Virginia State Congress of Branches for nearly 30 years. The NAACP faced an increasingly hostile environment following the Brown decision. The period of massive resistance that ensued forced the organization to fight for its very survival. You know, of course, that there was a special session called state legislature. 23 anti-desegregation acts were passed by the legislature, 7 of which were aimed at the NAACP. Local lawmakers were not shy about stating their intentions. Delegate James Thompson of Alexandria declared that with this set of bills, we can bust that organization wide open. That previous February, Richmond News Leaders editor James J. Kilpatrick had written to Senator Byrd. He said, "I would toss an old battle cry back at the NAACP. Hell, we have only begun to fight." State of Virginia had essentially declared war on the NAACP. Hindsight is always 20/20. Looking back, it's clear that NAACP attorneys were initially overly optimistic, and I think any of them still alive are saying that they were overly optimistic about the implementation of Brown. One historian who worked with the NAACP attorney said, in a sense, these men were profoundly naive. They really felt that once the legal barriers fell, the whole white-black situation would change. Alvin Hill himself explained that his optimism was based on the belief that Southern whites respected the law. When the U.S. Supreme Court declared school segregation unconstitutional, Hill noted that, and these are his words, many Negroes experienced a rude awakening that white folks reputed great respect for the law. Perhaps someone who was not surprised by the level of white resistance was civil rights attorney Samuel W. Tucker. S.W. Tucker, as he preferred to be called, was central to Virginia's legal campaign with the NAACP. He has not gotten as much attention as his contemporaries. As a founding partner in the Richmond, Virginia law firm of Hill, Tucker, and Marsh, he is best remembered for one of his several civil rights cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, Green v. McKinney County in 1968. Which, according to one source, did more to advance school integration than any other Supreme Court decision since Brown. He is also remembered for organizing the 1939 sit-in and then segregated Alexandria, Virginia public libraries. Tucker was born in Alexandria, Virginia, June 18, 1913. He later said, "I got involved in the civil rights movement on June 18, 1913. In Alexandria, Virginia, because I was born in At age 14, he caused quite a stir in Alexandria by refusing to give up his seat on a streetcar to a white person. That was 1927. a few years before Rosa Parks. Having earned his undergraduate degree from Howard University in 1933, Tucker was admitted to State Bar in 1934 and began practicing in Alexandria. There, he organized the sit-in and filed a suit to begin the exclusion of blacks from the city's public libraries. That lawsuit resulted in the branch library being established exclusively for Negroes only. In a 1940 letter to the librarian of the White's Only Library, Tucker stated that he would refuse to accept the call to be used as a segregated library. World War II interrupted his practice. Tucker entered the army, serving the 366th Infantry and combat in Italy, rose to the rank of major. After the war, Tucker moved his law practice to Emporia, Virginia. During the 60s, he joined Oliver Hill and Henry Marsh, formerly Hill, Tucker, and Marsh Law Firm in Richmond. And as the black civil rights struggle came into full flower during the post-war era, Tucker was often found at the center of its legal battles in Virginia. Tucker was the principal lawyer for the NAACP in a number of post-Brown school desegregation cases. He played a part in the lawsuit that ended the state tuition grant program that allowed black children to attend segregated academies at public expense. He was involved in cases that challenged the death penalty as being racially biased. He fought efforts to exclude blacks from juries. All this legal work meant that Tucker often carried a heavy caseload. In 1967, for instance, he had about 150 civil rights cases before him. Perhaps Tucker's greatest legal achievement was in bringing this new King County against the Supreme Court declared freedom of choice could not be sustained if it did not produce a desegregated school system. In addition to bringing cases, Tucker was also active in the leadership of the NAACP. He served as chairman of the legal staff of the Virginia State Conference, representing Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia on the National Board of Directors. Sam Tucker was an American hero. I'm particularly fond of a story that he shared with me more than 20 years ago, when he and I were talking about the kinds of threats that he received to his life. Oliver Hill received threats, anybody involved in civil rights work during that time received threats. And Samuel Tucker clearly received his share of death threats. The anonymous notes called these kinds of things. But he said, you know, sometimes we had to be creative when we dealt with these kinds of threats. And he explained that to me, that on one occasion, he said, for a period of several weeks, he would get an anonymous phone call every night, like clockwork, a little after midnight. The voice that had become very familiar to him was always the same. Male caller would always greet Tucker with a hello there, after which he promised to burn down his house the following night. Tucker said he really didn't like the idea of leaving his telephone off the hook. He was at his wit's end as to how to stop these late night phone calls. This is, of course, before call, we didn't call, I didn't call, all that stuff we have now. So he said one night when the guy called, he decided to change his tact. Rather than hang up on the guy, he engaged him in conversation. Asked him how he was doing. He was telling him that his late night calls would be a little bit disruptive. And so he says to him, look. And he really didn't say look. He says, you know, if I cannot sleep because of your phone calls, I'm going to have to find out where your mama lives. So I can go hang out with her, and maybe she and I can have a little midnight fun. That guy never called him again. I want to say a few things as the other part of my paper, and I've got a few minutes left, to talk about the role that Tucker and other lawyers in the state played in helping to train the next generation of NAACP workers, and that had to do with the youth, and that's already been discussed this morning, and it was raised in the Q&A following the first panel. More so than any other civil rights organization, the NAACP leaders committed themselves to involving the next generation in the fight for racial justice. Stan Tucker was a very important part of that. The crisis had encouraged the formation of youth units for a number of years before any official action was taken. Finally, in 1935, at the NAACP convention in St. Louis, Juanita Jackson, who served as special assistant to Walter White, a national youth director, gave an impassioned address in favor of creating a division for youth. She became the first youth secretary in 1935, September. Incidentally, 3 years later, she married Clarence Mitchell, who served as NAACP's chief lobbyist for more than 30 years. The first annual student conference of the NAACP was held at Virginia Union University in Richmond, Virginia, March 1940. 53 delegates registered from schools and colleges all over the United States. In 1943, the Youth and College Division initiated the first National Negro Youth Week, which was held in April and May. Among the first organized lunchtime sit-ins, the purpose of integrating segregated establishments was one held in Wichita, Kansas, in 1958, at a place called Dotton Drugs, which was a store in the old Rexall chain. In early August, the drugstore became desegregated. A few weeks later, August 19, 1958, in Oklahoma City, a nationally recognized sit-in at the Katz Drugstore, K-A-T-Z, Katz Drugstore, lunch counter took place. The Oklahoma sit-in movement was led by NAACP Youth Council and a leader, a woman named Carolyn, who was a local high school teacher, and these local students, and they worked to desegregate that lunch counter. It took several more years, but she and her students, many of whom were part of the NAACP youth chapters, using that sit-in tactic, it would eventually integrate all of the eating establishments in Oklahoma City. Today, if you visit downtown Wichita, Kansas, you will see a statue depicting a waitress at a counter serving people, and that commemorates the sit-in. Fox says 2 minutes and 10 seconds. I'm waiting. Following the Oklahoma City sit-ins, the tactic of nonviolent student sit-ins spread to other cities, such as Nashville, Tennessee, and Greensboro, North Carolina. You know those stories very well. The point being that the NAACP youth divisions acted first, though this historical fact has largely been forgotten. Since its founding in 1909, NAACP has provided and has trained more leaders for the black community than any other organization. Virtually every black American leader, public and private, local and national, learned the spirit of public service and the techniques of leadership through the NAACP. Roy Wilkins, Ronald Jordan, Andrew Young, Patricia Harris, Thurgood Marshall, Ralph Bunche, Julian Baum, many others served their apprenticeships in the association's youth councils and college chapters. On a personal note, in 1974, as president of the Essex County, Virginia youth chapter of the NAACP, I attended my very first NAACP state convention held that year in Newport News, where I had the honor of meeting Lester Madison. Today, there are over 500 NAACP youth councils, high school chapters, and college chapters actively involved in social justice advocacy by addressing local issues as well as national issues. And one of the priorities is voter registration. The NAACP is the only major civil rights organization that encourages young people to participate fully in all aspects of its function, including membership and on the National Board of Directors. Today, Youth College Division of the NAACP remains one of the major training instruments for young people who are committed to social justice and equality. Indeed, they have no shortage of NAACP trailblazers to look to for inspiration. 1 second, 0. Thank you.